This is Radio West. I'm Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of the show. And here at Radio West, we have an obsession with stories. A story, a good story, sucks you in immediately. It establishes an emotional connection, and that connection provokes an intimate personal response. You start to care. You become curious. You want to know more. You need to know more. And one person who's really good at doing this is the writer Christopher McDougall. McDougall is interested in how humans move and how we're naturally built to move, which is interesting, but without that human connection, it might not be any more than that. So when he wrote a book about parkour and the limits of endurance and how you fuel that kind of effort, McDougall did it with a story. And it's a good one.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Christopher McDougall must have known his extraordinarily popular book, Born to Run, would be a tough act to follow. The book, as you probably know, really started the barefoot running movement. And as he considered the next project, he had a hard time choosing between two different ideas. He wanted to continue his exploration of natural movement, but there was this other story that he couldn't get out of his head. It was a story from history, from World War II, and how these scrappy Greek resistance fighters and eccentric British commandos had held off the powerful Nazi invasion of the tiny island of Crete. And at some point, McDougall realized the two ideas came together perfectly. Those fighters, he realized, who battled the Nazis were heroes. And when McDougall uses the word hero, he's not thinking about it in some vague, noble way. He has a very particular concept of what that means. In fact, he calls it the art of the hero. And the art of the hero, he's learned, is also the art of natural movement. McDougall says, heroism isn't an accident, and it isn't a virtue. It's a skill. The fighters on Crete were tapping into an ancient heritage of skill and compassion. He's joining us today to talk about his book. It's called Natural Born Heroes, How a Daring Band of Misfits Mastered the Lost Secrets of Strength and Endurance. Christopher McDougall, of course, a journalist, a writer. He's worked as a contributing editor for Men's Health, as a war correspondent for the Associated Press. Christopher McDougall, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
I loved your synopsis of the book. That's perfect. Yeah, better than anything I could have done.
I don't think so. So did I get it right? I mean, this idea that on the sort of in the wake of the incredible popularity of Born to Run, you hadn't finished saying what you wanted to say or exploring what you wanted to explore about natural movement. But then you also heard this story from World War II, and they somehow came together. Is that that's it, right?
A weird thing happened when I was researching Born to Run. I was after we had that race down the Copper Canyons. I went back to research further the backstories of all the people involved. So everybody who's down there with me, Scott York, Barefoot Ted, I went to their homes and spent several days or a week living with them and just finding out everything about their own lives and everything they saw down the canyons. And just by coincidence, when I was at Barefoot Ted's house, he got an email from a guy named Erwan Lacour, a French guy living in Brazil, who was researching something he called the natural method. And Ted said, hey, look at this guy. You should check this out. And that's what got me involved. Like, I'd never heard of the natural method or natural movement before. There's that element. And the concurrent element was I was reading Percy Jackson and the Olympians, the amazing Rick Riordan series with my daughters.
Yeah.
And that's when those two things began to blend. You have Camp Half-Blood where people are learning the art of the hero.
Did it strike you at some point, these do work together as a book. I can put these together. And the idea of the hero came to you at that point?
Yeah. It took a while. So I was looking at natural movement and researching that information. And then I became intrigued by what was happening on Crete. Because, you know, I'd come across a little reference while working on Born to Run to someone called the Cretan Runner. And at first I assumed this was like a marathon or an ultra marathoner. And then I realized, oh, no, actually, it's the wrong kind of runner. This guy was a foot messenger. Yeah. So I sort of backburnered that, put it aside. It didn't pertain to Born to Run. And then when I started looking into the ancient Greek art of the hero, I went back to this Cretan runner, and all of a sudden, bam, this amazing story unfolded.
You see, the Greeks didn't wait for heroes to appear. They built their own. They didn't think it was an accident. This was a very particular skill.
And I always had a notion of the Greeks as being sort of fanciful and walking around in togas and believing in like unicorns and all kind of nonsense, Pegasus. But then you start to examine them and realize, no, these are extraordinarily practical people. The myths were not about fanciful tales. They were all survival tips. And of course, it makes sense because
the survival Greeks, tips.
Survival tips. The Greeks didn't have the opportunity to subcontract the way we do. Like my house is on fire, I call somebody. Yeah. My car is stolen, I call somebody. They didn't have a standing army, so every person was a soldier. There was no police department, so everyone's a police officer, which means if you're relying on everybody else, you want to make sure that those people are reliable. And so they didn't wait for a hero to accidentally show up. They thought, let's look at the common denominators that we all have and just elevate those common skills to the point where they're very useful in a crisis situation.
We'll come back to this a little bit later, but this idea of being reliable seems really critical to the idea of a hero.
That's all it is. Their point is a hero is just a protector. That's what the word means. And if you are counting on someone to protect everybody else, you want to make sure that they can respond.
One of the things you've said is that in some ways we have these natural instincts, inclinations kind of buried inside of us. And I guess your sense of it is in some way they've gone dormant, that we've kind of forgotten about the natural way to move? Is that how you explain it?
Yeah. You know, we always have this eternal existential crisis of our cerebral cells and our animal cells. You know, we have a body that has evolved for movement. We are incredibly movement-oriented animals. Yet we have a brain that is equipped to conserve energy at all costs. So there's this constant balance. So most of our existence for 2 million years, we had to respond to lots of emergencies in our natural world, but we have very successfully eradicated most of the emergencies. It's rare that I'll be chased by a cougar. It's right. Not going to happen. So I don't need to conserve that strength anymore. So now we've removed the emergencies. Our brain is still conserving the energy and our bodies are dormant.
I want to set up the story that really is the thread, this story, this remarkable story from World War II, and I don't want to give it away. So we'll tantalize people with it. It involves the island of Crete, tiny island of Crete, and the resistance of the Cretans was so crucial. I didn't realize how crucial this resistance was in the war, because the Nazis figured it would be easy. They were preparing to invade Russia. And Hitler did not want to invade Crete. But he gives in eventually. And this was such a crucial – would you set this up for us, this part of the story? Because this is really important.
You know, it's funny. Once again, history is written by the victors, and the victors of World War II are essentially the U.S. and the U.K. So what we read about are Normandy and the great troop movements. But what we forget about is there were these other indispensable moments that have been sort of lost. And one of them in particular was what happened on the island of Crete. So at the beginning of World War II, what Hitler faced was a Western Europe that had been devoting itself for 30 years to doing only one thing, keeping all the Germans in Germany. Everyone in Western Europe knew at some point Germany would try and break out again. So the Maginot Line was created. Every major military operation was devoted to stopping the Germans. Right. And it failed miserably. I mean, Hitler just raced through Western Europe in a matter of months. Once he had conquered Western Europe, all he had to do was defeat the Russians, which is pretty easy because the Red Army was crap. The Red Army was awful. Yeah. Stalin didn't trust any competent generals.
He killed all his the good generals.
Anybody who's good enough to save the country is good enough to conquer him.
Right.
So he gets rid of him and puts in political stooges. So Hitler's looking at Eastern Europe like, this is a cakewalk. The only thing he wanted to do was secure that little stepping stone in the Mediterranean. Crete was very useful as kind of like a big Costco warehouse. It was a nice place to store troops and supplies, get them off to Eastern Europe. So he's looking down this island. He's like, okay, 24 hours, no problem. We knocked off France in 5 days. This essentially undefended island shouldn't take more than 24 hours. But what he wasn't counting on was Crete is the only place in the world where the resistance began the day the Germans arrived. The civilians raced out in the streets and instinctively began fighting back.
Tell us about Chris White. He's a critical player here. You mentioned he's not a scholar. He's not a military historian. He doesn't really have much of a taste for war, you say. He's kind of a pacifist. But he has this obsession with this story, I guess.
I learned a valuable journalistic lesson. Like, when in doubt, find a Brit.
Right. Right. We have the same philosophy here at Radio
West. Amazing. Whatever you're interested in some basement in the UK, there's some guy who's been researching it nonstop for 15 years. I had a lucky accident. One of the people involved in the main narrative that I'm writing about was still alive. This was a guy named Patrick Lee Fermor, this wild, crazy playboy poet and kidnapper.
Yeah.
He's still alive. I know where he lives. I have his address. So I began writing and FedExing him letters, but I never heard back.
How old is he now?
Well, he passed away. He actually passed away during the writing of the book.
Right.
But he was in his early 90s. And I knew where he lived. I couldn't get a reply, so I thought, you know what? I'm just going to doorstop him. I'm going to hop on a plane. I'm going to go to his house. I had a layover in London, and during the layover, I thought, maybe this is a bad idea. I just thought – I was a little anxious. So through my publisher, I was able to contact a woman named Artemis Cooper, and I knew that she was a family friend of Patrick Lee Fermor and his biographer. And but she had been ordered by him not to publish anything until after he died. So I got her phone number and said, I'm thinking about going to see Sir Fermor. And she said, if you do that, you are dead. You are dead to everybody who knows him. It's a terrible thing to do. Don't do it. Come see me instead. What she explained was he was such a bon vivant. He knew people from all around the world. But at his advanced age, he could no longer recall when someone showed up at the door if it was a stranger or a friend. And he found it very unsettling and it made him very unhappy. And she said, if you had surprised him in that way, that I would have been shunned by everybody who knew him. Hmm. So instead, she and her husband, Anthony Beaver, one of the preeminent military historians, they took me in and they gave me the keys of the kingdom, everything I needed. And in addition, an unexpected tip, which was they said there was a social worker in the town of Oxford who probably knows more about this than we do. Go see Chris White.
And Chris White becomes such an he's your guide. And I want to say this too. One of the things that's really interesting, we can talk more about this as we go, a hero needs a sidekick. So this idea of you two together retracing this amazing sort of effort seems part of the story, this connection that you have with Chris in particular. But that this idea that it's about connection is really interesting too.
It is, and it's something I haven't fully got my arms around. It's something that you can understand intellectually and emotionally, yet it's hard to make those two things come together because I think we come from a culture of rugged individualism.
Yeah.
All you need is yourself. And the Greeks always said, absolutely not. The solitary hero is the loser. He's the guy that ends up failing. It's the person who's connected. The greatest of the Greek heroes is Odysseus, always connected to his family and his people. Achilles was much of a loner, and when his sidekick died, there goes Achilles. So with Chris White, and the best way I can articulate this is like this, is it's the act of sharing and explaining that brings out the best of you.
Yeah.
You open yourself up and suddenly you start to grow in ways you hadn't seen. So I know for a fact that Chris White opened me to things I never would have explored. And I hope humbly that I helped him do things he might not have done otherwise.
What did he love about the story? What was the – did you figure that out? What was his obsession, do you think?
Yeah, I do know what – obsessed him about it was the fact that it was so gentle. He's an extremely gentle man himself, very loving, warm. I mean, his job is to help the helpless in the town of Oxford. He works with elderly people and the homeless. And I think what he loved about this was in an island nation that has been obsessed with self-defense and offense and colonization. Mm. It's like, you know what? What if people just weren't mean to each other? What if people were nice? Like, what could you accomplish by niceness? There's a wonderful movie, by the way, Lars and the Real Girl.
Yeah.
The whole premise is just that. It's like, what if people treated the mentally ill with some compassion? And that's the first relation between National Born Heroes and Lars and the Real Girl, by the way. But I think what Chris White loved about this was there were a gang of misfits who thought, what if we just try not to kill people?
How much do you want to say about the kidnapping?
Let's go everywhere except to the conclusion.
No, I don't want to remotely go there, but I don't even know. I didn't even know if you wanted to talk about it. I just didn't want to put you on the spot.
I'm okay with it. I think it's a brilliant notion. And the fact is, it is every step of the way. You've got no idea if this is going to happen or not.
Good. Okay, good.
Sure.
So, all right. So, and this is such an important way of thinking in terms of the art of the hero, that it's incredibly pragmatic. So if you think about it, you have these kind of ragtag collection of Greek resistance fighters and crazy eccentric British, I guess, commandos, really, Although I don't even know what the word is. They're romantics in some ways.
I think misfits. I mean, leftovers.
Misfits, yeah.
If you were any good at fighting, you were in the army.
Yeah.
Whoever they didn't need, now you're in the underground.
And these were Churchill's guys. We'll come back to that. But
sure.
They strike upon this idea that they don't have remotely the same kind of firepower and brute strength that the Nazis did. And so they had to be crafty. And so they came up with this idea to kind of mess with the Nazis.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a beautiful thing. So Hitler sends in 80,000 German soldiers to occupy this island. I've been on this island. I've walked the entire island twice. There's not a lot of places to hide. It's a small island. 80,000 Germans is a lot. And so, again, Hitler gave a 24-hour deadline. Conquer this island and we're on our way to Russia.
Right.
Because if the snows are going to fall, we can't doink around in the Mediterranean. We got to move.
Yeah.
10 days later, they can't get control of this island. Hitler's losing his mind. So once they finally control the perimeter of the island, Hitler gave an order. He said, from now on, you rule this island with extreme brutality. No messing around, no Geneva Conventions. Anybody who steps out of line, you put a bullet in their head. And he sends in a guy named Friedrich Mueller, who became known as the Butcher of Crete.
Yeah.
So this is what they're up against. 80,000 German soldiers and a guy with open license to kill anybody he wants to anytime. So that's when this little band, you know, guys like Patrick Lee Fermor and a guy nicknamed the Clown, they said, you know what? We're never going to defeat 80,000, but maybe we only got to get one of them. And then the other 79,999 will always be looking over their shoulders.
That one is a German general.
Right.
And they nab him.
So originally what they wanted to do was get the butcher.
Yeah.
Like, let's get the butcher. Yeah, this guy's a bad guy. Let's get him. And also they insisted, Patrick Lee Fermor insisted, we don't kill him. We keep him alive. We want to keep him alive. So then when he pops up suddenly in an Allied prisoner of war camp, people are like, what happened? So unfortunately—
Was this psychological warfare in some
totally,
way?
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. That was the idea. And again, it comes from the whole idea of the Greek myths. You know, you just play with people's minds. You know, the gods appear and they disappear. You never know where they are. They're always taking another form. And again, this art of the hero had survived on Crete forever. This is the island where Zeus was allegedly born. So that when Patrick Lee Fermor comes up with this idea, he's suddenly tapping into kinship. Like, we know exactly what you're talking about. And so that was the idea. Let's get this guy. But of course, there's lots of flaws with the plan. Number one, it's an island.
Yeah.
There's nowhere to go.
Yeah.
And number two, it's very hard to get the most protected person on the island. So the butcher actually was transferred into a thing called the Fortress of Crete. But they didn't give up. They said, okay, I'll tell you what. Let's just go get his replacements.
Yeah. Talk about so you have these British misfits. Tell us a little bit about them. Churchill comes up with this idea, and his generals hated the idea.
Right.
But because it's like, what are you going to do with these crazy academics? And that's who he was appealing to, these romantics who knew ancient Greek. They knew the stories. They knew the art of the hero. They knew how to talk about it. And they turned out to be the difference.
So you have to imagine the scenario too. At the beginning of the war for the UK, they were on the verge of defeat.
Right.
What they were preparing for was not to strike back, but to actually work behind the lines, because Hitler was poised on the edge of the English Channel. And in fact, if he hadn't gotten overconfident, he could have crossed the channel and invaded England. But they were reeling so badly, he decided, no, let's move on to Albania and the rest. We'll circle back and get them. So what Hitler was actually preparing for was, once the German invasion began, he needed people to pop up behind the lines and start working as sabotagers behind enemy lines. And the only people he thought could do that would be the only people the Germans wouldn't suspect, aging academics and librarians and that kind of thing. So these are the people he recruited for his dirty trick squad. And he had a lot of experience with dirty tricks, because the British had been on the receiving end of it forever. With the IRA and the Boer Wars, wherever the British went, there was always a clandestine mob that was extremely effective at confounding the organized troops.
Well, Churchill was like this himself. I mean, he was a runt. He was bullied. He didn't really fit in, you know, and so I think that seemed appealing to him.
Again, it's one of these things where we're so used to the bulldog image, you know, the surly guy with the cigar stub in his jaw, that we forget that when he grew up, he was extremely frail, very sensitive, sickly. And he thought, you know what? If this sickly kid can transform himself into a fighter, then anybody can.
Lawrence of Arabia comes up as well. Same kind of idea. They have this kind of tenacity, and they're small, but brilliant.
brilliant at realizing that there are other people they can learn from. We tend to look at whoever's above us to learn from. And these guys thought, no, actually, there are other people that we tend to step over. They know a lot more than we think.
Well, we need to take a break, and we'll get back to the story. Christopher McDougall with us, his new book, fascinating, called Natural Born Heroes, How a Daring Band of Misfits Mastered the Lost Secrets of Strength and Endurance. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
If you're an employee of the University of Utah, consider using payroll deduction to support KUER. You can designate an amount to be withdrawn from each paycheck. Then, each time you listen to KUER, you'll feel proud, knowing your generous bi-monthly contributions support the programs and news you depend on. To get started, head to KUER.org and click Membership under the Support tab.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Christopher McDougall is back with us. You probably remember McDougall, who wrote the book that kicked off the barefoot running craze. Well, he's written a new book that also explores human movement, but it's also an adventure story from World War II. McDougall learned how these misfits really held off the Nazis in the island of Crete. They did it, he says, by using their body's natural abilities, like the elastic recoil webbing called fascia. He's hoping to get people to go outside and climb and jump and throw to practice what he calls the lost art of the hero. His book is called Natural Born Heroes, How a Daring Band of Misfits Mastered the Lost Secrets of Strength and Endurance. You mention in the book the person who first made you realize heroism was a skill was this remarkable middle-aged principal, Norina Bensel.
Yeah. And I'll do my best. I don't know why. It just strikes an emotional. I don't look out the window as I talk, so I don't look you in the eye. I just start welling up whenever I talk about her because I don't know why, but it really strikes me really profoundly. She was an elementary school principal in a rural town not too far from me. And when you go to her school, there's nothing around. It's cornfields in every direction. So one day she was looking out her office window and saw someone fumbling with the door. And then a mother came in and was buzzed in, and this gentleman slipped in behind the mother. So Norina assumed it was someone's father, didn't know the protocol, so she went to ask him what he wanted. And when she confronted him, he pulls a machete out of his pants and attacks her. And what she did then and continued to do was a series of decisions that really meant that the kids got out of there alive. If she hadn't acted in a series of events, it would have been much worse ending.
These decisions she made were instinctual. They were instant decisions that she made. And one of the things, and this is where you get to this part in the book, she didn't go muscle to muscle with this guy. That would have been impossible. He was crazy. He was enraged. He was strong. She relied on her fascia. Explain what that is, because this is a really critical part of the story.
So the ancient Greeks believed that the art of the hero was based on three things: compassion, skill, and strength. But their definitions of those words are very practically based. They're not our sort of fanciful notion. So compassion, number one, is about extreme awareness. It's perception. It's knowing what's going on and being able to read people.
Yeah.
Because compassion, it's not about being soft and gentle. It's about, look, if your second cousin is experimenting with crystal meth, you want to know about that before your car disappears. So that's what their notion of compassion was. So that's one thing that Norina Bensel had in abundance, was this extreme perceptiveness. She's reading people all the time. So her first instinct when she sees this guy is to understand that he has to be drawn away. So she didn't scream. She didn't run. She didn't plead. What she began to do is maintain eye contact with him and back away as he's coming after her with this machete. So, how do you know to do that? I have no idea.
Well, so but you mentioned that what was going on is she had to master her amygdala.
Right.
And that's the fear conditioning part of the brain. In other words, fear is not going to be helpful right now. So I've got to overcome that. But it was something that had kicked in. What was going on there?
So your amygdala prevents you from trying new movements. Your amygdala is the protective part of your brain, which assesses whether you've ever done this thing before.
Yeah.
That's why it's hard to ride a bike at first, and then it's easy for the rest of your life. Because once you master it, you have the amygdala memory. It's not muscle memory. It's brain memory. Okay, we've done this before. We're good. And that's what happened with her. And I think it's because she was used to dealing with children and angry parents all the time. So she's used to maintaining eye contact. Secondly, again, it's a weird thing. She's a saxophone player. She's used to using both hands. So both her hands came up in front of her protectively. And as he came, she maintained eye contact and backed away and fended him off with both hands.
And she was a hugger.
That was the thing about it. So he's attacking her. She got into her office, locked the door, sounded the alarm. But it was a step too late because the kindergartners were already getting ready to leave at the halfway point. So as the alarm is going off, the kindergartners are already pouring into the hall. So the man with the machete starts to go after them. So Noreen comes out of the office and goes back. That's what just breaks me up. I'm trying to talk about. She goes back out there. Who goes back out there?
Right.
It's crazy. She's a 53-year-old woman who'd never been in a fight in her life. And he basically gave her up for dead. She was so bloody and hacked up, he thought that she's done. And when he turned his back on her, that's when she just did the one motion that her amygdala could sign off on, which is to wrap your arms around someone and hug them. And she said afterwards that she did it to him. She said, I did it to comfort you. You needed comfort, and I comforted you. But what it also did was it turned her body into like a human lasso. She didn't have the muscular strength, but because your entire body is web, it was this extremely tough, fibrous, elastic recoil muscle known as fascia. Once she linked her arms around him, she became like a steel-belted radial. And at that point, his arms were locked up, and he dropped the machete.
Fascia is not about brute force. It's the, how do you describe it, the sticky, gunky, as you said, web that connects us, connects our body. This is how you put it in the book. Fascia knows where you are in the world.
It's a sensory organ, right? And this was a major breakthrough that only happened the past 5 years. A guy named Dr. Robert Schleip, head of the Fascia Research Institute in Germany of Ulm University. And what he discovered was, for a long time, everybody's all about muscle. But when you actually look at a cadaver, there's a little bit of muscle, but there's a lot of fibrous tissue. And if you look at a baseball pitcher, they're not aiming. You know, it's not like they're aiming. They pull way far back, and then they unleash like a human catapult. And the reason why is your fascia can tell during that entire extended motion of throwing a ball exactly where you are in relation to the ground, to the air above you, and to the person at a very small target 90 feet away.
It's interesting you talk about how chimpanzees, for example, are not very – they can't throw very far, first of all, or very hard. It's about something else other than brute force.
And this is where – this was the most important breakthrough in human history. More than anything else, the greatest innovation in human history was the moment we learned how to throw with force and accuracy. So a chimpanzee has all the anatomical requisites to throw the way we do, but what it can't do is think into the future. And that was the pivotal moment when we learned how to throw not where something is, but where it's going to be. We were able to create a reality in our minds that didn't exist yet on the planet. And that became the launching spot of creative imagination, technology, literature, language. Mm. It all came from this ability to think into the future and create something in our minds. And that's what's so amazing about this was it was a combination of hardware and software. The hardware of this elastic recoil muscle, but the software of activating it in a future tense.
You threw tomahawks with this great guy named Joe.
Yeah.
In Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Not far from your house, it turns out. That's really weird. But it's a great scene because he's sort of telling you that there's a Zen component to it. You can't aim. You have to do it in another kind of way.
On my website, I have videos of this woman named Zolette. She's a middle school science teacher in Florida. And you got to check these videos out because she's in her kitchen with like butter knives, and she's winging them, and she's laughing, having a good time. But what you notice is she's utterly relaxed. This whole notion of throw like a girl, watch Zolette, and then say throw like a girl. And what you realize is the more you relax, your finger is hardwired to your brain. It knows where it wants to go with instinctive aim.
One thing that you consider in the book is this idea that being a hero, like why would any heroes really exist? Because it doesn't make any sense biologically in terms of natural selection to be a protector for someone who doesn't have your genes. So why would that work? Talk a little bit about that part of this story because it doesn't make sense biologically.
This is something that confounded Charles Darwin, for instance. He's looking at DNA. He's looking at genetic transference and adaptation. So I thought, wait a second, why would anybody risk their lives for someone who's not genetically related to them?
Yeah.
And even Andrew Carnegie, who was a sort of a master card shark. I mean, this guy made billions by outthinking other people. And he became so fascinated by heroes. It was the one thing he could not figure out. And he actually created the Carnegie Hero Foundation.
Still exists, right?
As a research tool.
Yeah.
It was less of a benevolence association as a way of like culling and gathering all these stories. Like, what is going on here? And here is the thing that I believe they were missing. They were looking at humans as purely reproductive machines. But the thing about it is that we are hunting pack animals, that we have always gathered and collaborated, and the pack is only as strong as the weakest link. So if you know, there's someone in the pack that is not holding up, that's going to draw predators. So you always want to know what's going on and help that weakest link to make the pack, the whole sort of circle, much tighter and stronger.
That's such a theme in the book, I have to say. This idea of empathy and compassion, which you wouldn't think of that as being a component of the hero. Carnegie, you mentioned in the book, he eventually kind of gives up figuring it out. Like, I can't figure this out. And what he says is, one of his conclusions is, heroism is impulsive. But you say that's wrong, in fact. And you talk about how the ancient Greeks devised this test for telling the difference, in fact, between impulsive and heroism.
Right.
Would you do it again? And could you do it again?
Yes. So what we're looking at with Darwin and Carnegie is these are products of the machine age. They're looking at things which can be reproduced and moved on. This is the Industrial Revolution taking place. So this is where we start to move away from emotion and get into replicating things. And what they forgot, though, is that, again, we are physical animals.
Yeah.
And that physical animal self is what the Greeks were looking at. A very simple thing. You know, could you do it again? And would you? And that's what they're trying to do. Compassion and strength and skill.
I want to ask about another component that you talk about, and that is using fat rather than sugar as fuel. This was a critical – first of all, tell us how this applies to the story of the Cretans and the British. I mean, because this goes to diet. This goes to this goes to endurance. How did that work in this – just tell us how that worked in this particular story, because these guys were able to go for sometimes – miles and miles and miles with hardly anything to eat.
So one thing I was always careful to do is anytime I came across something which seemed to be a piece of the puzzle, I wanted to make sure that this same piece would appear again and again throughout history. I wasn't looking at any kind of one-off, you know, mutation. I wanted to see if there was actually a timeline. So looking at fascia again and again and again, you find people rely on instinctive aim. The Wild West shooters, Zolette in her kitchen, people who don't need – they can use their fascia to throw. The second thing I was looking at was I was puzzled by the mystery of how on earth you take a guy like the Cretan runner who was delivering messages on foot. Now, how on earth is this guy going 50 miles through the mountains with no food supplies, delivering a message, getting a reply, and going 50 miles back? That's 100 miles without any aid stations or cliff bars or Gatorade. Where on earth are you getting the actual caloric energy to do this? And what I discovered was, again, there has been a tradition of using fat as fuel. And whenever it pops up, people perform extraordinarily well. The difficulty with it is that most of us are in a constant sugar cycle. We're constantly eating starches and sugars and high glycemic, fast burning fuels, which we then have to replace again and again throughout the day. But you know, you could throw someone in a life raft with a couple of gallons of water and they'll be fine for 3 months with no calories whatsoever. And what they're basically doing is their metabolism has changed so that instead of relying on sugars, they're relying on their body's superabundant storage of fat.
Did the Greeks understand it, do you think? Or does it just happen?
They didn't have to understand it because they didn't have the resources. There wasn't any Haagen-Dazs around.
Right.
So when you look at the Mediterranean diet, which of course is, you know, now applauded as the world's healthiest diet, that's the Cretan diet. And that diet is all about using fat as fuel.
One of the things also is preventing the heart rate from exceeding a certain mark. And there's kind of this, I don't know, formula is the right way to put it, but you write about this as well.
Right. So fat as fuel has two components. One is limiting your body's, limiting the sugars in your body.
Yeah.
But secondly, it's keeping your body out of the emergency response mode. So again, think about this. If you're a shepherd in the mountains, you don't want to be sprinting all the time. You want to be pacing yourself, keeping your heart rate down. And what it tells your body is there are no emergencies, So let's use that stored fat. In an emergency, we'll look for sugars. Sugar is, you know, it's the gasoline.
Yeah.
What you want is a nice slow-burning log. And so by keeping your heart rate at a nice low level, then your body says, okay, things are cool. Let's use the fat. And what we find, though, is that even when performance athletes have trained their bodies, cut the sugar out, keep the heart rate down, they actually end up getting faster and faster.
Wow. Are you trying to dial it in?
Yeah, yeah. You know, here's the funny thing, too, Doug, was all these things that you think are extremely elaborate, they're easy. 2 weeks, and you can actually start burning fat as fuel.
Do you have to monitor your heart rate when you're running and stuff? Is that
how
it works?
Well, there's a guy named Phil Maffetone, and he was extraordinarily in vogue in the 1990s among Ironman triathletes. The best Ironman triathletes in the world were doing the Maffetone method. He's got his own weird saga. He's actually now living out in the deserts of Arizona playing music because of a little sort of tragedy in his life. Yeah. But I contacted him. He's like, yeah, it's 2 weeks. And I was a doubter, but I tried it, and it works extremely well.
Mark Allen, the greatest triathlete, I think, in history, he figured this all out. What did he have, 6 Ironman titles?
I can't remember if it was 6 or 7.
Something like that.
Mike Pigg, Stu Mindelman, all these extremely successful endurance athletes, they actually all came to Phil for the same reason. They're injured, they're broken down, they're ready to quit. They come to Phil Maffetone, and in a matter of weeks, he completely restores them.
Carb loading, that's kind of a myth.
Yeah, carb loading, again, it's one of these unfortunate commercial products that we developed because it's nice. You know, carbs can be packaged and sold.
Let's talk about natural movement. Georges Hébert. Is one of the figures who really starts thinking about this idea of natural movement, and tell the story that got him thinking about that. He's involved in this volcanic eruption. He manages to survive, of course, but thousands of people didn't, and that gave him some insight.
He was a French naval officer,
yep.
Based on a troop ship off the island of Martinique. And when the volcano on the island began to explode in the early 1900s, he hops in a lifeboat and starts steaming towards shore, hoping to save people. And what he sees is horrifying. He's watching tens of thousands of people die, and only because they just can't execute a few simple movements. They can't swim a few yards offshore. They can't pull themselves up a rope. They can't lift a 40-pound child. You give them a 40-pound box, no problem. But human bodies are sort of unbalanced and slippery, and it takes a certain act to pick them up. And what George Bear is wondering is, like, why are humans alone among the animals on the planet? Why are we unable to save ourselves? Every other animal can figure things out and escape, and he's watching it happen around him. Yet we humans are helpless in a crisis. And what he realized was, up until age of 5, that's what kids are doing all the time. How many times do you tell kids, get down off that, stop doing it, stop kicking your sister, stop fighting, stop running, stop, stop, stop. The instinct as children are to practice these natural movements, these defensive movements, to run, walk, and climb, to jump, to throw, to catch. But then at the age of 5, you put them in a chair and say, now don't move for 15 years.
Yeah.
And after you get out of that chair, move to another chair and stay there for 25 more years. And anything you don't practice, you lose.
So how are you running now? How are you moving now? I'm trying to imagine. Are you trying to find places where you're jumping from rock to place? I mean, there's an urban component to this, which we'll get to in a minute, but what do you look like when you're moving these days?
I shudder to think. Just don't videotape me. But what I've tried to do is randomize my movements as much as possible, and I've also tried to incorporate things that I think I can't do. So one thing I can't do or couldn't do was climb a rope. So one of the things that Bear talks about a lot is getting your body up off the ground. It's really crucial. We spend a lot of our existence as climbers. Most of us can't do it. So I'm like, oh, geez, I'm one of them. So I bought a 30-foot rope, and I slung it over a branch. And I'm afraid of heights, too. So there's a lot about this I don't like. And as a heavy guy, I can never climb the rope. But then I realized, again, it's not a strength situation. It's a skill. And you actually learn the skill of climbing a rope. It's not that hard. So now every day at my desk, I can see the rope out there. And whenever I'm, like, messing around on Facebook, I go out the door, climb the rope. When I go for a run, whenever I get to a hill, I get down on all fours and bear crawl up. I just try to add as many what they call QM, quadrupedal movements, as possible.
You tell the story. You were in some shop in your hometown. You're in Lancaster,
right.
Pennsylvania. And all of a sudden you see this something shoot by, and then another guy shoot by. And Tell the story, because this parkour element, this idea of these people who are using urban space, adapting this kind of movement in this other space, it plays another part in this story.
So I keep it all this stuff kind of backwards. A lot of people had heard of parkour from YouTube videos. I hadn't seen it. I hadn't heard of it.
Huh.
But because of studying Georges Hébert and natural movement and what happened on Martinique, I knew that Georges Hébert was considered the godfather of parkour.
Right.
So I knew he's the godfather of something. I didn't know what it was.
Right.
And then there I was in a Rite Aid pharmacy, you know, standing in the checkout line, and there are these narrow windows. And again, I see these guys go flying by, like they're like sort of catapulted out of a sling. And I thought, I wonder if that's it. So I went outside, and they were doing these jumps back and forth across the handicap rails. And it looked really cool, because they'd be on one railing, jump across to the other, and actually land on top of the railing. So I said, hey, is this parkour? And I said, yeah, it is. Can you teach me? And they said, well, you're actually in the wrong parking lot. You want to go to London, and there's a group there called Parkour Generations.
Yeah.
But what was really cool about that was they have an all-women's class on Thursday nights. And one of the key things that Georges Hébert always said was, if it's natural movement, it's natural for everybody. Not just for men, not just for young people. Men and women, old and young alike. And that is what natural movement really is. So I thought, okay, let's put this to the test. Let's go check out a women's parkour class. And I still think I have bruises from it. They beat me up pretty good, but they were amazing.
In North London, you met these three women, the Movement of Three. They told you this. I think it may have been is it Andy?
Auntie.
Yes. Yeah. Auntie, sorry. Who told you it's not magic, it's ass elevation.
Yeah.
Explain what that means. That's another interesting part of this. And also this idea of being weightless in space. I mean, it's such an interesting idea, this idea of movement. Talk about what she meant by that.
I just feel like that should be a T-shirt slogan.
Right.
It's not magic. It's ass elevation.
Yeah.
What happens is we become so comfortable on our butts or on our feet. Yeah. We tend to be rooted to the ground, and we start to lose that comfort with shifting our body weight onto our hands. And so that's to vault over railings. It's actually not hard. It's not muscular. It's just about the confidence to shift our weight off of our feet and onto our hands. So again, this video, Movement of Three, you watch it. It's unbelievable what these three women are doing. But they're not trained gymnasts. One's a nurse. One works in a real estate office. One's still in school. But they fly across the landscape. And essentially all they're doing is trusting their bodies to fly through space.
You say we've lost our taste for being weightless in space. What do you mean by that? Like when you're a kid and you like jumping on a trampoline? Like the idea of floating, jumping?
Right. I think it ties into our native ability to be climbers, to get up off the ground. And so everything, you look at everything kid wants to do, swing set, trampoline, sliding board, it's all about flying through space, being weightless. But once you become rooted in that chair, that instinct goes away and you start to become cautious. And because, again, the amygdala is switched off, hasn't done it in a long time. And that's one of the things I believe, strange as it may sound, I think one of the most important sports in the planet today is parkour.
There's this moment you tell about when you were swinging over this rail and you said to this person, I could do nothing but this all day. What do you mean? There's a kind of joyous feeling to it, or it seems natural to you?
It's the focus on skill. And I think one of the places we really have gone off the rails is we always focus on the end result. It's not the training for the marathon. It's running the marathon. It's getting the result. How fast are you? Who can you beat? And when you actually start to focus on the skill becomes all-absorbing. I like to think of like painters. You know, if painting was easy for Picasso, he'd become a sculptor. He'd move on to something else. But it was the challenge of the skill, the minute skill that absorbed him. And so with parkour, when you first try to do a simple thing like a precision jump, a very, very simple motion, but you're never quite right. It's always a little bit off, and you just want to keep doing it and doing it. And that's where I think people would enjoy exercise so much more. Instead of like trying to lift the big weight or get the big time, focus on the minute skill involved and you'll be utterly absorbed.
Is it have something to do with just having more fun?
Yeah, it is fun. It's also activating your brain.
Yeah.
And most of it trying to shut our brains off, you know, where we have earbuds in, we're watching something, we're talking to somebody.
Yeah.
We're trying to detach our brains from the physical aspect, but actually get your brain more involved in the physical aspect. That's what play is. Kids are creating a fantasy world that they're involved in. You know, they're playing army or war, cowboys. Their brain is completely involved.
Let's go back to Chris White. Because one of the things you wanted to do was essentially go and trace this remarkable story in Crete. What did you learn about movement from Chris? Because he doesn't seem like – I mean, he doesn't look like a long-distance athlete, but he has something some understanding of – I don't know, of movement, I guess it was, that you noticed.
So what happened was this irregular band, they actually succeeded in grabbing the general against all odds. But now they're still on an island, and they're being pursued by 80,000 extremely irritated German soldiers. Yeah. Under direct orders, you get him at once. And so this band is on the run, and they are running recklessly through the mountains, zigzagging around, trying to get to the most inhospitable reaches, places where the Germans couldn't follow them. So very hard terrain. So Chris White was able to painstakingly recreate every single step of this route, which Patrick Lee Fermor himself didn't know where he was because he's in the dark, and he's running for his life. And so I recreated this with Chris. Again, I think I'm coming off a Born to Run. I've been training. I've done ultramarathons. This guy looks like he wants a pillow chair and a newspaper. I cannot keep up with him. And that's when I began to really focus. Like, what is he tapping into? But I think there were two things. Number one, he wasn't competing with me.
Right.
He was just out there in the mountains. His head was up. And secondly, he was utterly relaxed, just bouncing and flowing along.
So so when you go on these fun runs, for example, I'm not sure they're all. You're always trying to retrace the story that you, in Crete, but do you try to adapt some of those lessons that you learned from Chris, the Cretan runners, to show other people what you mean by this concept of natural movement?
I learned the same lesson from a guy in Born to Run, barefooted, a guy that I tease all the time, and yet every 2 years I realize, oh yeah, somebody said 2 years ago, now I'm doing it. And one thing Ted told me was, you know, most people are out there practicing pain. They're in the gym and they're rehearsing things that make them hurt. He goes, I don't practice pain. I practice pleasure. I have fun. If I get tired, I stop and pet a dog. I have a drink of water.
Right.
And that's what I remind myself, is that in a world of survival, you want to be smarter than the thing you're hoping is going to die. You want to be relaxed and having fun all the time, as opposed to pushing yourself to the point of desperation.
What kind of – it's the book's just out. It hasn't been out so long. What kind of reactions are you getting? Are you getting the same kind of intrigue that you got with Born to Run? These, again, people reconnecting with something kind of deeply, deeply embedded in themselves.
The reaction has been unbelievable. We did some events. I had some parkour specialists, some female parkour specialists traveling with me. We do one event, and I told people at the end of our talk, all right, I tell you what, boring people can stay here, get the book signed. Fun people go outside and go play some parkour. Right. And we had this apparatus set up. I go outside. It's all the 70-year-olds who are climbing on the scaffolding, jumping over things. And what the parkour people told me was the kids started, but they could see all the sort of more advanced age people watching, waiting for permission. As soon as they waved them in, they just lunged. And I found this at event after event. Curiously, it tends to be women 40 and above that want to do this. And I think the reason why is they want to consider themselves athletes. They don't want to be doing something indoors, a yoga, Zumba. They want to be outside. And this is the ticket. So that, to me, was the really surprising, gratifying thing, is that people really want to do this stuff.
I want to come back to the other really crucial component of being a hero that the Greeks mentioned, that the Greeks had in mind, and that is the idea of compassion, empathy. Plutarch, you mentioned the fascinating section of the book, conceiving of this idea that that's such a critical part of it. And how you thought of finally with Chris, because this idea of being a hero, you said, was that we have to answer to someone. Say something about that, if you would, finally.
And the reality is, people are not going to do things they don't want to do. So we can scold and nag and say, you oughta. But people aren't going to do that. People are going to do what they want to do. And they're going to act towards things they feel are in their self-interest. And that's where I think what Plutarch was getting at is, understand that helping somebody else helps yourself. Chris White sees this. He lives in a town of Oxford. These are his neighbors. So if someone is dying on the street, it's his neighbor that's dying on the street. And at some point, this heartlessness is going to come back and affect him. And I think that's the thing. I feel like we live in this sort of hectic, antic world where we're trying to carve out individual space for ourselves. And we forget that just by opening our eyes and realizing that we're connected, that actually makes things better. And it's the monocular way of looking at things that causes the problem.
Christopher McDougall, the author of the book Born to Run. His new book is called Natural Born Heroes, how a daring band of misfits mastered the lost secrets of strength and endurance. Christopher McDougall, congratulations. Thanks very much.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
I'm Doug Fabrizio.